Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. If you want an instant snapshot of some of the tensions in New York City right now, just take a look at Cory Johnson's Twitter mentions. That is, people tweeting who mention Cory Johnson, the New York City Council Speaker, who may also hope to be elected mayor next year. The top mention, based on likes and retweets, is from a criminal justice reform advocate who writes, "Bill de Blasio, Cory Johnson, and every member of the New York City Council voting for this budget would rather cut $65 million from a program that subsidizes public transit for low-income New Yorkers than cut it from the NYPD." But just down from that is one from a tweeter on the political right that says, "Protesters harassed Cory Johnson's boyfriend, vandalized apartment," quoting a New York Post headline. "Johnson is the far-left New York City Council Speaker leading the movement to defund cops. Now he's crying because the dog he turned vicious bit him." You get the idea. It is a tough time for New York City, and therefore a tough time to be in leadership, with, according to the numbers in today's New York Times headlines, 1 million jobs lost, nearly a 20% city unemployment rate, 64 people shot, including 10 killed over the July 4th weekend. Then there's the unknown number of people coming into the city every day from the 16 states on the must quarantine coronavirus list with questionable ability to trace and monitor them. Against that daunting backdrop, we welcome for his monthly appearance here, New York City Council Speaker Cory Johnson. Hi, Mr. Speaker. Sorry under the circumstances, but welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me as always.
And so part of the debate right now, as I signaled in the intro, is whether the number of shootings over the weekend and in June as a whole has anything to do with criminal justice reform or releasing people from Rikers Island because of COVID-19 risks in the jails or general attitudes toward the NYPD right now. Here is NYPD Chief of Crime Control Strategies, Michael LaPietri, on the Rikers question from his point of view.
We recommended 96% of that population not to be released. It was ignored. And now we have more victims and we see the lawlessness on the streets.
Mr. Speaker, your response.
Well, Brian, you said it in the opening. The last 3 months in New York City have been incredibly difficult and challenging in so many ways. Hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers without their jobs because of COVID-19, over 22,000 people who have lost their lives, a national reckoning and a reckoning in our city over 400 years of racism and systemic racial injustice against Black and brown Americans and New Yorkers. And the city is at a real inflection point. So it's been an incredibly difficult, challenging few months for New Yorkers across the board. With the economic collapse, crime has clearly gone up in the last few weeks, especially, and in the last few months. And I think it's important that when we talk about these things, we talk about these things in that context. We understand that a lot has happened over these last many months that has been challenging. And it's really important, I think, for those of us who are in positions inside of government, not just even elected officials, but also people that serve in government, that we be thoughtful and nuanced and contextual about these things, that we talk about the challenges that have got us to this point. Now, I don't think that it is fair to say that the reason why you're seeing crime and the reason why you're seeing shootings is because of criminal justice reform that has happened. There has been criminal justice reform that's happened nationally, on the state level, and in New York City. And it's been happening over the last few years. And crime was trending down until, you know, a little bit more than a year ago when we started to see some increase. If you look at the context of where we are crime-wise, we aren't where we were many, many years ago, where, you know, you had thousands of homicides and murders every single year. But still, these numbers are incredibly alarming. To have this many shootings, to have this many people killed, is scary for New Yorkers. And I think we need to look at the root causes of that. We still need to reimagine what policing and public safety looks like. We need to get illegal guns off of our streets. We need to actually use programs that we know work. And no one is saying, at least I haven't heard anyone say, that people that are out there shooting up people should not be away from society. And so for someone to draw that line and to somehow try to link these things together, I think is a inaccurate depiction about what criminal justice reform is about, and is really sort of demagoguing the moment that we're in and not talking about what has brought us to this moment today.
And listeners, as always, when Speaker Johnson is on, we can take your phone calls for him, your chance to speak to the speaker or ask him a question at 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, or tweet a question at Brian Lehrer. The NYPD Chief of Department, Terrence Monahan, appeared with Mayor de Blasio at the Mayor's Daily Press Briefing yesterday and said there's a level of animosity or antagonism toward the police that he hasn't seen before, and that it includes more people who are being arrested physically resisting. His implication is that the reform movement has also led to more danger for both parties in those encounters and in people who are suspected of criminal activity, not protesters, feeling that they can get away with that. What do you think?
I don't know what that is based off of. I don't have any information that would inform me being able to understand what that means. I mean, the bill that we passed in the council, a bill that was passed at the state level, bills that are being passed across the country on banning chokeholds and the type of conduct that murdered George Floyd in Minneapolis, the type of chokehold that killed Eric Garner on Staten Island, that is what there is, I think, broad support, and not even just amongst elected officials, but amongst Americans and New Yorkers, that those type of tactics are completely and totally unacceptable. And to, again, try to link these things together to say that because the New York City Council and because other legislators in New York State and across the country decided that we are not going to stand for people to be treated that way by police officers, again, I don't understand the linkage here. I mean, I think that in this moment, it's important that we try to take the pressure down a little bit and actually speak about things in a factual way, to not ratchet things up when so many people are on edge. This is a moment of transformation nationally and in New York City. It is a moment of reckoning, and I think it's a moment that we need to recognize by being thoughtful, not just how we look at public policy, but also how we speak to the public.
You're getting a lot of criticism from criminal justice reformers who say the billion-dollar NYPD cut that you and the mayor touted in the new fiscal year budget that passed last week is largely fake. Among those who might also run for mayor next year, Scott Stringer calls it a bait and switch. Maya Wiley calls it moving the deck chairs around. Here's an Occupy City Hall protester speaking to New York One.
There's smoke and mirrors, right? The overall headcount of the NYPD is still not changing. The actual overall budget, even though they're moving around numbers, is not changing. What is changing is cuts to social funding, to a lot of the community-based organizations. A lot of our funding is going to be cut. So no, it's not. They're actually not an answer to it. It's a lot of smoke and mirrors.
Your response to that, Mr. Speaker?
I don't think it's smoke and mirrors, Brian. At the beginning of this conversation, and when I say this conversation, not the conversation you and I are having right now, but at the beginning of this conversation on looking for significant cuts to the NYPD. There were lots of things that were identified on how to get there. One of the big ones was moving things that the NYPD has typically done away from the NYPD to other agencies that are not law enforcement agencies. That's what we are doing with school safety agents. That's what we're doing with homelessness. That's what we are doing with crossing guards. We are moving those away from the NYPD. They still need to be funded in the city's budget to still do some of that work. But I think this moment is actually about even reimagining that, not looking at school safety in the same way, not looking at how we interface with homeless New Yorkers in the same way. This is about investing in education and in housing and in preventing homelessness and in social programs and human services and programs for young people. And I'll tell you, Brian, in the weeks leading up to the budget being passed, I spent, as did other council members, countless hours in a painstaking way going literally budget line by budget line, trying to restore as many of these programs as possible. And it hasn't gotten headlines, understandably, because people are disappointed and focused on the NYPD number, but we restored, the council restored $100 million in cuts to fair student funding, which go to some of the poorest schools in New York City that need help. We restored the cut to the CUNY ASAP program, a nationally acclaimed program for CUNY students, which are predominantly Black and brown young people in New York City. We restored funding the Single Shepherd program, which are for guidance counselors and social workers in the South Bronx and Central Brooklyn. We restored money to the Youth Jobs program and the Cornerstone program and Beacon program and so many of these programs that help young people. So literally, line by line, we went through and we worked on trying to restore those programs that are helping communities of color, that are important for COVID-impacted, vulnerable neighborhoods and communities, and we did that. Was it the exact amount of money that I wanted? No, I wanted more. Did I want a bigger cut to the NYPD? Yes, I did. But part of my job of being speaker is finding consensus. You had the mayor who did not want to go anywhere close to where we got. You had some council members who wanted to go a lot farther than we went, and some council members who didn't want to go as far as we went. So a part of my job was to try to find consensus to have a budget before July 1st so that so many of these programs that we care about actually had funding, like the Youth Jobs Program, like food pantries. So I understand why people are disappointed. I do think this is the beginning, not the end. We were not going to solve policing in New York City in 5 weeks. And I know that there's a lot more that we need to do. And I'm committed to doing that work moving forward with my African-American colleagues and listening to communities of color across New York City.
The tweet I read at the top from a reform advocate asked why you would rather eliminate the Fair Fares program, which subsidizes Metro cards for low-income New Yorkers, or did, than take that $65 million from the NYPD. What do you say on that particular contrast?
That's not accurate. So let me just explain it. The Fair Fares money wasn't eliminated from the budget. It was re-estimated. So we had budgeted a certain amount of money for Fair Fares, and in the budget that we just passed, we took that number down to where we see spending actually going. And part of the reason why the number came down is because, as you know, from COVID, subway use has been down dramatically. And so the amount of money that we think is actually going to be needed to run the program in the way that we've seen the number of ridership be at, we think is going to be lower. So the program was not eliminated. That is a program that I fought for in my first year as speaker in 2018. It's one of the programs that I'm most proud of for New Yorkers that aren't acquainted with it. It's called Fair Fares. It was dreamed up by the Community Service Society, one of the leading anti-poverty organizations in New York City, coupled with the Riders Alliance. And it's a program that provides half-price Metro cards for New Yorkers who are living below the federal poverty line.
So let me be clear, because
in the budget.
So that program will still be available to people who meet the same income criteria as before. It's just that
that's right.
Because there's lower subway ridership, you think that will be fewer people and cost less money.
Exactly.
That's what you're
saying. So because the ridership has cratered, even though it's gone up a little bit over the last 6 weeks since we started to reopen as a city, we don't believe it's going to be where it was pre-COVID.
Right, but the criteria are the same.
We don't need to budget the amount.
Because I don't want to give out false information, and there may have been incorrect reporting on some people's parts that led to the reaction that I cited to you. So I just want to be very clear. If somebody qualified based on their income for fair fares previously, they're going to qualify today.
That is my understanding, yes. And how we negotiated the budget, that is my understanding.
Michael in Hell's Kitchen, you're on WNYC with Speaker Corey Johnson. Hello, Michael.
Hey, just for your last point, I got a new job like a year ago, so I don't qualify for fair fares anymore, but the last statement's a lie. I was on public assistance and food stamps for a few years before that. Never got fair fares. Second point is, I think Speaker Johnson is losing a lot of support, myself included, as a young gay man in his district. I'm very disheartened by his lack of leadership. When it comes to budgeting, I think he talks the talk. He's a very good speaker. I think you said three important things, Speaker Johnson, and that is looking upstream, right? So when we talk about looking upstream, we're thinking about social determinants of health. And I think, too, that reform is not possible. And we just can't continue to think about reform when the whole orchard is rotten from the ground up. I'd like to see more leadership and more vision. I'm really disheartened by the army of, I'd say, LGBTQI politicians, from Christine Quinn to Richie Torres to Buttigieg, who are backed by oil lobbyists or the NYPD unions. I want to see more vision from you. I know that you have it in you, but I want to see more.
Mr. Speaker, speak to your constituent.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael, for that call. I really appreciate it. Brian, I don't really agree with, I mean, I don't really disagree with much of what Michael just said. I would just say that on the first point on fair fares, just to be clear, it is for people who are living below the federal poverty line. So I don't know if the circumstance that Michael was in, he would have qualified depending on his income at that moment. So that might be where there is some confusion. On the second point, I didn't use the word reform. I used the word reimagine. I think this is a national reckoning on what policing should and should not be. And that's why I think we need to say, what is our vision for public safety? And one of the things that we need to do is say, there are things that we have relied on law enforcement for decades that now we recognize is not appropriate, like on dealing with homeless people. We did not get in the budget, which I was disappointed in, how to get them out of the mental health co-response teams, to say that the school safety officer should not be part of the NYPD and should move to another agency. So that is not reform, that is reimagining. And I think we need to do that on everything related to policing. At the same time, we do have, shootings through the roof, and there is still going to be a need for us to deal with violent crime, not just through policing. That we need to look at the roots of this. We need to look at the programs that work. It needs to be a combination of things. So these are hard conversations. These are difficult things that we need to work with communities on and with community leaders on and members of the clergy on. This is the type of work that needs to happen. And again, this is the beginning of the conversation, not the end of the conversation. We passed a series of bills the middle of June. We worked on the budget, and I know a lot of people aren't happy with where we got. I think it's a good first step that we need to build on. But this will be a conversation that will continue for a long time.
A tweet that came in says the budget places a hiring freeze on teachers, counselors, parks workers, and nearly every agency. Why does it not place a hiring freeze on the NYPD?
I wanted it to. So my position was to cancel all four of the NYPD classes. The budget agreement canceled two of the classes, the April class that was delayed until July, and then the July class, which was the combined April and July class, which was a little less than 1,200 police officers, new police officers, that was canceled. There are two additional police classes that happen outside of those two classes, and my position was to cancel those classes as well, which would have been a hiring freeze. The mayor was not there and was not supportive of that, and many of the council members were not there and weren't supportive of that. People explained that when they cast their votes during the budget vote. And again, part of my job as speaker is to find consensus. I was pushing really hard on the mayor. I was trying to get the council to go as far as we could to go to that $1 billion. And let's be clear, we didn't get $1 billion. I'm not going to play games and pretend like we did. Some of the things that were included in there on TEA enforcement and ticket writing and fringe costs associated with the NYPD, that I don't think is a number that gets you to $1 billion. But we did get hundreds of millions of dollars that is being cut from the NYPD that was put towards some of the programs that we are talking about. So, Brian, if it was up to me, we would have actually done a true hiring freeze. But one of the difficulties of, you know, being a legislative leader is finding consensus in the body and then also negotiating with the chief executive on this. And that is what I tried to do. We didn't get as far as I wanted personally, but I still think it is a step forward that we can build on in the future.
Mehdi in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Mehdi.
Hello. Yes, good morning, Brian. Good morning, Mr. Johnson. I'm a proud parent of five BLM kids. They're all born in New York City and associated with Black Lives Matter movement. I have a suggestion for my kids and all for and politicians like Mr. Johnson and de Blasio and all the other politicians. That movement is really excellent. What they did is phenomenal, but I want them to energize in a different way. Why not get involved with all this black shooting in Chicago and New York and have this movement come along and try to solve this matter as well in their own community? And I want your input on that, please.
Thank you. And I would question the use of the term black shootings, but you're talking about shootings in neighborhoods in New York City where most of the victims have been black and brown people. And Mr. Johnson, Speaker Johnson, what would you say to Mehdi, your take on the BLM movement, which he says he has five kids proudly in and supports, should it play a role, in your opinion, in dealing with the street crime?
Well, first of all, Mehdi, thank you for calling in, and I'm so happy that you're, of course, proud and supportive of your children for being part of what is the largest civil rights movement I think the world has ever seen at this point. So this is a moment of change and transformation. Again, I do think it's a reckoning for all of us, especially those of us who are not people of color, to understand our privilege and to use it appropriately to try to meet this moment that we are in. I would just say that's why I'm talking about why we need to reimagine and re-envision what public safety actually looks like. We need to say, how did police budgets get so built up over the years, not just in New York City, but across the country and at the federal level and state level? Why do we still have qualified immunity? Why are there not standards on use of force? Why is there still so much racial profiling that happens? Why do we have a punitive criminal justice system and how do we actually get to the root causes of some of the violence that we see. We know there are other models that are not law enforcement involved that work, just like on the Cure Violence model in New York City. So that's what I think this moment is about. And I think we need to think about that and how it's going to determine public policy moving forward in our city and nationally. That's what I believe Black Lives Matter is about. It's about recognizing that Black lives do matter, and that for too long our country, our state, our city has not recognized that in the appropriate way and made the decisions that actually recognize that. And now we start to have these conversations and move public policy to actually recognize that.
Let me go to the topic of unemployment. The Times article on this today contrasts the city with the rest of the country. National unemployment declined in June to around 11%. In the city, it's still around 18% as New York opens more slowly than many states that are now experiencing new coronavirus spikes. Is the city striking the right balance? And these are city and state and federal government responsibilities, but if people are at risk for eviction and for not having enough food, what are the city government's most important roles right now, even with the budget crisis that's the result of the economic shock?
Sorry, Brian, I just want to be clear. The first part about striking the balance, I'm not sure I understood. Striking the balance in what way?
Opening at the pace that we're opening,
okay,
and keeping unemployment so high.
Sure, got it. I mean, this is a question that I think people have been struggling with, not just in New York, but around the country and around the world, on how to do this appropriately and thoughtfully. You saw other states open too quickly, like Texas, like Florida, and now they are seeing a gigantic wave, which I guess is not a secondary spike because Dr. Fauci said that we are still in the first wave,
right,
of COVID-19. So we need to be thoughtful about this. And I think it was the right decision to not allow indoor dining on the date that we were going to allow it, out of caution and wanting to be careful about these things. So, you know, the
and
thing
on
that
dealing,
really
and I know helped, you have, I know you have to go in a minute, so you can say whatever you want, but I do want to know, because we can, you know, so that we don't take our eye off also people who are struggling so much with this unemployment, maybe having enough food or maybe not having enough food, maybe not being able to pay their rent, even though there's an eviction moratorium in place for directly coronavirus-related hardship. What are the city government's most important roles right now?
Well, I would just say, Brian, that a thing that I don't want us to take our eye off of is that yesterday, Mitch McConnell, who has been horrific and his comments have been totally appalling and unacceptable over the course of this pandemic, said that they are likely to move another COVID-19 related spending bill and bill to hopefully help Americans. And so New York City cannot solve this on our own. We just passed a budget with a $9 billion hole in it. We needed that state and local aid before we passed that budget. We didn't get it. The thing that will help people that are struggling, because we need to still take public health precautions for the next many months because we're still dealing with a global pandemic and we're seeing spikes across the country, the thing that will help us right now is they need to renew those enhanced unemployment benefits, the pandemic unemployment assistance program for freelancers and gig workers, that's $600 a week. We need money at the local level to be able to still help people who are struggling. Food pantry lines are down the block. We need money for our schools, for childcare, for all of these things. So the federal government has not stepped up in the way that we need, and that's what the focus, I think, needs to be for the next 3 weeks before the end of July, when the Senate will likely take up a version of the House bill that passed in May, the HEROES Act. That's what we need. We need help for people that are struggling. We need help for states and localities that need to provide these essential services on food.
And the thing that we could actually do, if our leaders in Washington recognize this, is we could have a real program that helps renters, that helps tenants, that helps people who can't meet their mortgage needs right now, that helps all of these folks. If we had a national program that dealt with that, that would be incredibly helpful, but we don't have that at the moment. And my hope is that over the next few weeks, the Senate Democrats and the House Democrats will be able to negotiate as much as they can to get that in whatever that bill looks like.
New York City Council Speaker Cory Johnson, thank you so much.
Thanks as always, Brian.